This is Duff Watkins, host of the AmCham Business Podcast. You know all the people that I interview on the podcast, the CEOs, the ambassadors, the consul generals, the overseas dignitaries. You can actually meet them if you come to AmCham events. That's where I met them. AmCham is the oldest, largest, most prestigious chamber of commerce in Australia. Why don't you think about joining? Go to the website, find out more. It's amcham.com.au.
This podcast is proudly supported by iLevel. iLevel's new innovative interactive video platform allows you to showcase your business knowledge. To learn more and view AmCham's interactive video, visit ilevelstudio.com.au/platform. Welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia, where you find out how business really works. AmCham podcasts are hosted by Dr. Duff Watkins. Duff is a director of Exec Search International, an author, and is also on the AmCham Council of Governors. AmCham, bringing business to you.
Hello and welcome to the podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia, where we explain how business really works. Here's a riddle for you, listener. What's male, pale, and stale? The answer is corporate boardrooms and too much of senior management. So that's why today we're going to discuss diversity and what does it really mean. We're also learning from a company that is regularly named as one of Australia's best places to work. My name is Duff Watkins. I'm your host on the AmCham Business Podcast. Today our guest is Kirsten O'Doherty, the general manager of the global pharmaceutical company AbbVie. AbbVie has been in Australia for 75 years, but its roots actually go back to the U.S. back in 1888, and AbbVie now operates in 150 countries. Their business is developing new products to tackle diseases, which makes life a lot easier for you and me, I can tell you that. AbbVie is rated among the 7 most innovative companies in Australia, and for several consecutive years, they're considered as one of Australia's best places to work. Now, let's find out why. Kirsten, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Kirsten, you started out as a pharmacist. Now you're on the leadership team of the Asia Pacific team for a global biopharmaceutical company. How'd that happen? Got to be a story there somewhere.
Yes, I started in hospital pharmacy and then moved into clinical research in the pharmaceutical industry. So my first role was in clinical research. And then I continued to study, moved into more commercial roles in sales and marketing, worked my way up. And ultimately, in the last 5 years, I've been the general manager for AbbVie Pharmaceuticals. So it combines my passion for clinical research and development of new medicines with the real business commercial skills as well. So it's a perfect role and I love it.
Okay, so what does diversity mean to you? It's a word we hear a lot. It means a lot of things to different people.
Mm-hmm. So I think diversity in leadership, which is really what we're talking about, is ensuring that your leadership team is a diverse group of people. We know that a lot of our employee base is diverse, our customer bases are diverse. It's very important that your leadership reflects the diversity of interactions we have with stakeholders and also our employer base. Clearly, a hot topic in diversity is obviously gender diversity. We do see a lack of gender diversity in a lot of our senior leadership teams, but I do think it is beyond female-male diversity. It is also age, ethnic background, diversity of experiences, etc. So I think true diversity really supports innovation, but also engagement and ability to interact and understand the external environment.
That just reminds me of it's an old study by the Australian Graduate School of Management, which found that boards which had diverse composure, that is to say males, females, different cultural, those companies perform better.
Absolutely.
Than the other stale companies.
Yeah.
So although I opened with a joke, there's a lot of truth behind it.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll stick with women for a second. What is preventing or impeding them to rise to more senior positions of management? And I'll jump in and say, I know it's not skills. I mean, it can't be skills because I'm an executive search consultant. My mother was a banker. I've seen women with skills. There's nothing new about that.
Yeah, totally agree. I think the reasons we don't see more women in senior leadership are multifactorial. I think there are two key things that I'm absolutely passionate about supporting because I think they're two of the key barriers to women taking on more senior leadership roles. One of them is workplace flexibility, and the other is return from maternity leave. And when I talk about workplace flexibility, I mean a genuine flexibility, not having a policy that says, yes, we have a flexible work environment. It's very attitudinal. It's a genuine acceptance and support for flexibility for men and women, or, you know, all employees. And I also think return from maternity leave is an area that needs to be really well managed, and many organisations don't get that right either.
Okay, well, let's stick with flexible work practices. What does that look like in fact? And I guess I should point out that AbbVie, as a company, walks the talk. In Australia, 78% of the directors and 76% of the senior management team are women, so it's a company that walks the talk.
So workplace flexibility is obviously having the policies that support that, so allowing part-time, allowing flexible work hours, work from home, those sorts of things, and also having the technology that enables that. That's been the biggest breakthrough, I think, in recent years. You know, FaceTime, Jabber, you know, the ability to be at a meeting at work, even if you're working from home, things like that make working from a range of environments so much easier. But it's more than having the policies. It's actually a very genuine acceptance that that is normal and appropriate, and that I think is the difference. So, you know, I work from home on a regular basis. A lot of my senior leadership team will work from home a day a week. It's not just about working from home, also, it's about, you know, maybe coming in early, leaving early, staggering work hours. It's all of those things that allow you to manage life, you know, and also support, you know, that feeling of control over work and the ability to manage it. I mean, we all work ridiculous hours. I work very long hours. But, you know, that ability to manage it and control it contributes enormously, I think, to engagement and choice about what people are doing. You know, and when we're talking about women in leadership, flexibility extends to things like, yeah, coming in early, leaving early, so they can do school pickup a couple of days a week if that's something they want to do. That also extends to men. We have a lot of men in our workplace doing similar things because childcare is so much more shared these days. But if you've got a couple of parents both working, flexibility, you know, it's enormously helpful for people to manage. Part-time work, people may be moving to 3 or 4 days a week of work for maybe a period of 1 or 2 years if they're studying, if they've got other issues going on, and then returning to full-time work at a different phase. People go through cycles in their life, you know, where they want to do different levels of work at different times. So that's genuine workplace flexibility, really supporting your very talented employees to feel they can manage and control work. And I absolutely see people are very passionate about what we do, very, very engaged. Everybody works very hard, very long hours. So huge trust. You know, you've got to have that trust that people are always doing the right thing and doing great work wherever they might be, whatever hours they might be working.
It sounds like this is one of the keys to being an attractive employer. It must be very attractive to some people who are not used to that. I'm guessing it must provide you with a competitive advantage.
Absolutely. It means people are highly engaged. We have no trouble attracting talent. We retain people. We have low voluntary turnover. We have exactly the right people that we want. And as I say, engagement, we all know high engagement absolutely results in better business outcomes. We know that. That's been proven over and over again in research. So having a group of people passionate about what they do, engaged and feeling able to control and manage their work is, I think, enormously beneficial. Very important to millennials too. We've talked about women, but if we're talking about the younger, and we have a lot of younger people employed at AbbVie, they absolutely are looking for that flexibility as a core part of their employment.
So it's fast becoming not just an add-on, but a requirement.
I absolutely believe so. I think if you look at workplaces of the future, companies that can't get this sorted just won't be successful in attracting people.
All right, let me jump to the other side of the ledger. What's the downside to this, having all this flexibility?
I think the only downside is if you don't also create a physical work environment that's attractive. If everybody is always working from home, and again, there's been a lot reported in media on this, you don't create collaboration, you don't create teamwork, you don't create connection. So you need to have a work environment where people want to come to the office, want to work with others, and are really engaged by that, but also it's getting that balance right. So we have a great work environment. We've spent a lot of money really creating a very positive work environment. A number of years ago, we moved into our new offices. It's an activity-based work environment, no offices, flexible, open space. So when you do come into work, the vibe, the energy, you know, you walk in and you can feel, you know, the energy in the workplace, lots of different people working together, connecting, collaborating together. And so that really attracts people. So although we allow working from home and we allow that flexible work environment, people tend to really want to be at work as well as maybe doing some work at home. And it's that balance which I think creates a really positive environment for people.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is how you manage and monitor this process so that people, the people that you're trusting, turn out to be trustworthy. But it sounds like if you've got a place of employment, if the office is not a place that repels you all the time, you actually don't mind being there some of the time, then it sounds like it's kind of a win-win for the company.
No, I mean, and look, you certainly, when we moved into the new offices, one of our objectives was to create a place, a physical place, that people wanted to be at and that they wanted to work together in. So create that collaboration. I mean, one of the key drivers for innovation is collaboration, and that was one of our key drivers, to create a work environment that was collaborative. Now, you cannot have a collaborative work environment if everyone's working at home. So, as I say, it is that balance, you know. However, also having time out to think and reflect is also really important for people, which is often where having that flexible work environment so people can manage both and allows people individually to work out what they need at particular times in the week. It's very important.
Part of work flexibility then is having women return from maternity leave, or I suppose for that matter it could be men returning from paternity leave as well. So, but let's stick with the traditional one, maternity leave. How does that work in practice and in effect in your company?
So I think it's incredibly important to actively manage and support women returning from maternity leave. It is a time when there's a lot of uncertainty. It's a challenging time for a lot of families, both men and women, managing that very big change in the home environment. And so you've got to be really actively supporting. So it's more than just saying, yes, we have, you know, support for return from mat leave. It is really working hard to support people returning from maternity or paternity leave. So things like making sure that women, for example, who are on maternity leave are still on the talent management list. If there are positions, new positions, promotions, that they are contacted, they're encouraged to apply. We've got recent examples of women being promoted whilst on maternity leave with still some months to run on their maternity leave. They've got the job, the promotion. We wait for them to come back from maternity leave. They may come back part-time for an initial period of time. So it's that sense of being on maternity leave doesn't mean you've left the organisation. You're still an active member of the talent pool that we have. So it's that, but it's also supporting return in a staggered way if that's what people want. You know, not everybody does want that, but some people, you know, it's the return, maybe even one day a week, 2 days a week, working, you know, gradually up, and maybe it's maintaining a part-time role for a number of years. And again, so many examples of women who've returned initially maybe a couple of days a week in maternity leaves, who some years later have ended up being promoted to our global head office in the US, where their partner was the one following them and they are the main breadwinner for the family. It is just about stages in life, but without that really active support for people returning and encouraging our talent to reconnect and re-engage and rebuild, you know, the career that they want to and not take a different path, I think that really ensures that you maintain women in leadership roles, because it's a time that a lot of women take a different path, not because they intended to, but just because they didn't think they had a choice. Often it's, I'll take a lower role because that's all I can do part-time.
Does that cause hassles in the work front? For example, when a woman goes on maternity leave and she comes back part-time, say, and I've seen both, by the way, some can't wait to get back to work and others are quite happy to string it out bit by bit. I can understand either way. But does it disrupt the workflow? Does it disrupt the workplace, the teams which they're supervising or managing? Does it disrupt the output and the productivity of the business unit?
I think if you have, again, this is where it's flexibility is so key, as long as you have flexible employees as well, because it does work both ways, and people you know, if there's busier periods of time, they may need to increase, you know, their hours for a period of time before going back down again. Those sorts of things are really important. But genuinely, if you've got talent and you're managing for that talent, you can absolutely manage roles in different ways. And so it also applies, I mean, we have, you know, it's not just a female-based issue. You know, we have men wanting to take a different direction in their career, maybe try a different role for a period of time, or maybe study, you know, go part-time. You know, there are lots of different things going on in people's lives. It's that ability to manage that. So as everybody is entitled to that, people have very positive attitudes towards, you know, let's just get the job done and we'll all work together.
I've said it a million times, if you get the right people in the right jobs, pretty much everything is self-sorting and they'll take care of itself.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not the best people, the right people. Yeah. You talk a lot about not making assumptions in various roles. Now, I know enough about neuropsychology. People are assumption-making machines. That's just the way the human brain works. You can't help make assumptions. The brain is always filling in blanks for things. But you say that's not such a good idea because it leads to making misconceptions about people, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah. And people make assumptions in with the best of intentions often. You know, I've heard people say, well, it's very difficult for a woman to be a national sales manager because of the travel involved. And so they aren't considered for roles. Or people don't, you know, when people return from maternity leave, oh, we shouldn't put too much pressure on them to return because they don't want to return, rather than let's create an environment where people can do whatever they want and they don't feel that they're letting anyone down by not, you know, working a particular way. So it's very important not to make assumptions about what people can and can't do. We should allow people to really make those choices themselves. And often our recruitment processes are filled with those assumptions. The assumption that a woman can't travel, that a man doesn't have good emotional intelligence, you know, and we often put people in little pigeonholes about what they can and can't do and what they're suitable for. And so you find those stereotypical female roles and male roles because people assume men or women are best suited to those. And often that's completely wrong.
Are there other sorts of assumptions you see at play in the workforce which you think we could do without?
I think some of the other assumptions that get made are, you know, men are stronger financially, women are stronger with emotional intelligence. And I think that is pure assumption. You know, I don't think it's played out in what I see in the talent in my team, but it's just often the sorts of assumptions people make, you know, about what people are good and bad at. And again, as it does lead to recruitment and certain people being in certain roles.
Women being, or men being better at finance, I think that's not so much an assumption as bull. I don't know if we can say that on the podcast. Rob can take that out if he wants, but that's downright funny.
Yeah.
Did I mention my mother was a banker?
Yeah. Well, and exactly, but and you know, as I say, I think there are a lot of stereotypes about what men and women, and also different ages. There's also assumptions about younger people not having the experience to be leaders, or older people, you know, not having the drive to continue to work and to travel and to, you know, be at high levels in careers. And I think, you know, so there's ageism operating as well. And
you mentioned, you're the only person I've ever heard he's mentioned this, like a person in a job might need work flexibility to take care not of children but at the other end of the spectrum, aging parents.
Yeah,
because I'm of the baby boom generation, and both my parents have passed away now, but there was a time.
Mm-hmm. It's a common thing, but it is...
Well, it's inevitable.
It's inevitable. And for a lot of people, you know, they have a period of time when their parents are dying, or, you know, may it be clear they've either been diagnosed with an illness and need more care, need more support. And it's often a period of time. And the ability to spend time when you need to at that time is incredibly powerful. So, again, we've got lots of examples of people maybe moving to part-time for a period of time to care for parents and then come back into full-time work. There's lots of reasons people need flexibility in work. Study is another key one. People wanting to study part-time for a period of 2 or 3 years. Lots and lots of things, you know, but enabling. We've got someone at the moment that's spending 6 months travelling around Australia with his wife. He's just taken a 6 month leave of absence. You know, it's a thing they want to do at a particular point. You know, why not?
We're talking about these inbuilt biases. You mentioned recruitment. I use a lot of psychometrics in my line of work in executive search just for that, to obtain objective information. And it's a way of sort of disciplining myself, because I make my own assumptions about people, naturally. What can a company do? What can a business do to become less vulnerable to their false assumptions?
It's a good question. I think one of the key things is recognizing that we all have biases, we all have assumptions. There is training that can be done. It is really important that people are aware the biases exist. And one of the key things that is important for managers particularly is to have that self-awareness that most people tend to recruit people just like themselves. That's what they actively try. You know, it's natural.
And
it's
take
the human
pride in
condition.
It, which is even weirder.
Exactly, exactly. It's actually very hard to recruit people that actually you might not necessarily be best friends with, you know, that they are sufficiently different to you in terms of the way they think and work and communicate, that's going to make them feel quite different. But that's what drives innovation. That's what drives performance when you have a truly diverse work environment, not just, as we say, from gender, but also different ways of looking at things, different attitudes.
I can give you three historic examples of people who recruited people who had very diverse opinions to themselves. One was Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. The other was David Ben-Gurion when he was founding Israel. And the other was Winston Churchill during World War II. He had stand-up, knockdown, screaming matches with his generals, but kept them on because, in fact, there was a book about Lincoln called Team of Rivals.
Yes.
And it was all about incorporating diverse perspectives so that you wouldn't make stupid, simple blunders, because no one would point out to you that you're making a stupid, simple blunder.
Mm. One of our core values is actually clear and courageous, which is that challenging challenger approach, which is groupthink is not good, be challenging. In our leadership team meeting, we've had a position that we've called provocateur, so their role, and it was rotated, but their role in the management team meeting was in fact to challenge everything. You know, why did we decide that? Why did we agree that? But to be deliberately provocative, because it is so easy to get into that groupthink.
The head of Ford said they would have these young people come in and they would look at their business processes and they would say to him and the senior management team, why are you doing that? It's stupid. It's inefficient. And they would get all precious about it, all officious. Well, you know, we are Ford, we're a multinational company. And he said, but after a while, you get over that and you say, just tell us how to improve it. Just tell us. And I was thinking to myself, that's when you're good, when you get over the preciousness about it and you just want the better way to do it.
Yeah.
And you don't care who it comes from, doesn't matter what their age is, but that's a hard thing. That's a hard hurdle for most of us to get over.
Yeah, and I think it's a corner mark of innovation too. You know, I think companies that are innovative and are focused on innovation, and again, you know, innovation capabilities, innovation skill training, one of the core essences of innovation and capability is that ability to challenge, is that ability to look for insights, to look for better ways. So if that is a core part of your culture as well, then you're constantly encouraging, is there a better way, is there a different way, what assumptions are we making, do we truly understand the problems? And that's just basic innovation training.
Okay, let me ask you a hard question now, okay? We said off the air, the composition of the management team ought to reflect the composition of the workforce. And so, for example, if you had 60% of your employees were female, then you reckon 60% of the leadership team ought to be female. But let me ask you, here's the hard question. Doesn't that assume that only females can represent females, only males can represent males, and only whites can represent whites, and only blacks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
I think my passion is to create a truly diverse leadership team that represents the employee base, but also represents the stakeholders that you're working with. Now, I do believe if you have 60% of your employees being women, they want to see 60% of management also being women, because if you don't have that occurring, what you're basically showing is that women have less of an opportunity to be promoted than men if you're not truly reflecting the gender diversity in the workplace with your management team. So I think it is incredibly important that we support leadership teams to be matched to your employee base, because it says everybody. You know, it's a skills base, it's a capability base that drive leadership, not, you know, we're not making it more difficult or more easy for some people. So I do believe your employee base and your management base should be not identical, but similar.
Simpatico, perhaps, yes.
Yeah. I do think, you know, that it's good if you can drive that naturally, you know, that's just a natural evolution. If you have workplace flexibility and the right recruitment practices where you're not making assumptions about abilities and capabilities, that will occur. You know, it is, you know, obviously the normal process is that you would be promoting from within and also recruiting externally in an environment that matches your employee base.
How do you prevent your flexible work practices from being exploited and abused? And maybe not even consciously, because, you know, people, it's my belief, people don't normally set out to rip off their employer, but, people cut corners, get a little lazy, get a little lax.
You have to have a very strong performance-based organization, and so in an environment where you are highly trusting your employees and you're very focused on driving engagement and allowing people to manage and control and contribute individually, I think it is also really important that you are very clear with accountabilities and expectations. And if people aren't meeting accountabilities and expectations, they are actively performance managed. So high performance organisations allow people to contribute to really drive performance, but they also have consequences for poor performance. We have a reasonable turnover of non-regretted losses. So we have about a 5% non-regretted turnover. We
do non-regretted losses.
I know that. It's not a great term, is it?
Oh, I love it.
But we do, you know, we track it, and and there's a whole lot of reasons. Sometimes culture fit's not right. Sometimes it's performance. But
that's pretty low, though. 5%. I mean, that's nothing.
Our total turnover is about 10, so we have a 5% regretted. You know, our turnover is pretty good in terms of, you know, we're a fairly mobile industry. But you've got to, if people aren't performing, if they're not meeting their accountabilities and deliverables, and again, that requires having very clear what is the expectation, and it's outcomes, not you will do this, you will do that, you will do this. It's you are expected to deliver A, B and C. How you get there, ultimately, people are personally driving. But you've got to be very, very clear about what the expectations are. And then if people aren't delivering to those, you need to manage that. And for high performers, that's an environment they like, because it's nothing more frustrating if you're performing really well and you're working really hard and you're doing a great job and, you know, you can see your colleague who's not doing very much work, is not contributing, and is getting exactly the same recognition and you know, rewards as you. You have to have an environment where the high performers are recognised, are, you know, managed, developed, you know, given extra training, you know, there are promotions, and the people aren't performing are, you know, that's addressed.
So it is, it's a business, and you remind them of that.
Absolutely.
And they either make it or they, but it sounds like you're tapping their initiative and their motivation and unlocking their creative potential to do it.
And giving control often to people to choose how they're going to deliver what they need to deliver.
Mm. As we've been speaking, it just reminds me of a true story I want to tell you about. A large multinational calls me up, and the general manager says, I want you to assess this person. We want to promote this woman into a role in our largest market, is in another state, with our largest customer. I said, okay, fine. He said, she's 24. I said, you're kidding me. Come on, man. That's way too young. He says, just assess. So they fly her in. I go out to the company. I assess her. She's young. She's 24. She's heavily covered in tattoos. I'm saying to him, come on, man. You're kidding me. This is not going to... So I do the psychometric assessment, and I interview her, and I say, she's pretty good, isn't she? she's got something to offer now. And so the task was, okay, how do we manage her to develop her? And I said, well, okay, she's strong here, she needs help there, she needs support there, and she's been going fine. It's been, I don't know, a year plus now, and pretty much performing as was indicated. So to me, that's just a real life, me being a middle-aged white boy, when I see some, 24-year-old with tattoos, I think, what do they know? Turns out, quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
A lot more than I thought.
I think development's essential, like tapping into what you just said. It's really, for everybody, it's one of the key motivators as well. It's having that ability to continually learn and develop. And again, an environment that's flexible really allows people to explore and do different roles. You know, we have a lot of people moving around in the organisation, often sideways into different roles, trying to...
Can you give me an example of that?
So sometimes it might be in a... you know, in a sales role or in a medical role where they might move around in between therapeutic areas. Mm-hmm. We have people moving between, say, commercial roles and analytics roles to gain different experience. We are actually, one of the things that is really exciting at the moment is we have quite a lot of people based in Australia supporting our area, our area, which is Japan, Asia, ANZ, we call mm-hmm. it JPAC. Mm-hmm. So they are people that perhaps couldn't travel, they didn't want to move. Our area hub is Singapore, and they've got roles which are, you know, maybe 50% based in Australia and 50% supporting their area of expertise in the area. So they're travelling a little bit, but they're able to live in Australia. So those sorts of things which allow development, it may not necessarily be a promotion as such, but you're learning different skill sets in different areas and things like that. And somebody doing that role for a few years may well then, in a few years' time, be able to move to Singapore and get a promotion. But it's often just at a point in time, it's developing and continuing to learn new things whilst, you know, staying maybe in a similar role.
Abby is illustrating it's so much easier to change the job to suit the person because you can't change the person to suit the job. And the other thing I you're reminding me of is 40% of a person's effort is discretionary. In other words, I come in, I punch the clock, I'm there for maybe 6, maybe 8 hours, you know, Kirsten. But and that's my 60%. You get that. You know, that's with the paycheck. The other 40%, you need to educe that from me. You need to somehow show me, inspire me, guide me, lead me, direct me to go that extra mile, make that extra phone call or extra sales call, whatever. And it sounds like you folks have a winning formula there.
But it is something that you have to constantly work at. I mean, one of the things we do is we do regular all employee surveys. We also obviously do the Great Place to Work every year, but you know, part of doing that is you get a really good benchmarking survey. You know, you compared to other great employers and you get a very clear indication of where you're strong and where you've got gaps. And so obviously for us, we do a lot of work analysing where have we still got gaps. I mean, agility is one of the areas at the moment that we have improved our score in a lot, but it is still one of the lowest scoring areas. And if you think about a highly regulated industry mm-hmm, that mm-hmm, we're in, mm-hmm. you know, so we're, you know, starting a project at the moment, you know, really working with some external parties, really focused on, you know, what are the issues with agility? What can we change? You know, what processes and systems do we have that we could maybe simplify, maybe remove, you know? So I think it's not a, oh, gee, everything's wonderful, but there's always things you can do better. And the environment changes. So something mm-hmm. you were strong at one year, maybe you've dropped the ball on another. So you can't ever assume you have the magic recipe. You have to constantly understand, analyse. Your employees change too. Mm-hmm. As we get more and more younger people in the workplace, we're going to have to continue to change. So it's not static. Mm-hmm. You know, it isn't static.
As we finish here today, Kirsten, is there one takeaway you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think for me, creating diverse leadership is incredibly important. I think it drives a work environment where you're really focused on innovation and engagement for all your employees. And I think it takes work and effort. And I think, but if you spend the time and effort in creating that diversity in leadership, your organisation will absolutely benefit from it.
And we've been unlocking the power of diversity with Kirsten O'Doherty of AbbVie. And you've been listening to the Business Podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. We value your opinion. If you're listening to us through iTunes, you can easily hit the subscribe button or leave a review or make a comment, all of which are very appreciated because we want to know what you want to know. What are the topics? Who are the people you would like us to talk to? Any issues that are of interest to you we want to know about, just email us podcast@amcham.com.au. In fact, you can listen to all of the podcasts on the website. That's amcham.com.au. This is AmCham bringing business to you. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Business Podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. This podcast is proudly supported by Twitter Australia. Twitter connects everyone to what's happening in the world right now, from breaking news and entertainment to sports and other everyday topics. See what's happening in the world live as it unfolds. AmCham, bringing business to you. AmCham's annual trade mission program is your window into the USA. Join us for an unforgettable week visiting senior executives at iconic American companies from a range of sectors. Don't miss your chance to join one of our select delegations this year. Visit amcham.com.au.